me for a moment while I brag, but it's just kind of fun to watch him. The kid's already got a love for music, because if he's upset and crying, if you start singing, especially if Pete starts singing, he just quiets right down and stares at you. And the moment you sing the last note, he's right back into his fussing. But he loves music. So I look for him to be writing symphonies and what do you call those? He'll be the next Beethoven, right? He is a child progeny. I threw that one out one time when Ethan was little. He's a child progeny. Say, aren't they all? Progeny means child, right? Prodigy is the word I was looking for. So, okay. Anybody have a testimony they'd like to share this week? Something the Lord's been doing in your life and you're just excited to tell us about it? Kimmy. Yeah.
He asked how homeschooling was going. And I just, like, you know, you try not to let it catch your breath, because it's so good to ask you, you know, like, you get that question every day. But my goodness, my father-in-law just asked how one of the most important events in our lives is going. And I praise God, because that's huge. That's a softening that I never would have expected to see. So it was just a question in passing, and
you know, if you ever run into homeschoolers like us or some others, you might realize that homeschooling seems to be an extremely important thing to them. And I'll try to fill you in, because I know that for most people it was, you know, do the public school thing. And long about the late 1970s, some people started making different decisions and saying, hey, no, let's pull them out and homeschool them. So it's not the normal for American society, and there's still only about 2 million of us right now, but it's growing in popularity. But one of the reasons that homeschool is so important to us is because homeschool is not about the education. You can get great education in a lot of different places, but to many homeschoolers, homeschooling is an extension of their parenting. It's an extension of their desire to see their kids walk and follow the Lord. And so we do homeschooling not because we think it's the best education, because in some cases it's not, but we do homeschooling because we think this is, for our family, the best way to implement God's commands to disciple our kids. We get a lot of time with them. We get a lot of interaction with them. And this is how we spend the time that we want to spend with them in order to train them in their character and in try and instill biblical faith in them. So homeschooling is not just our education option to us. It's a really big part of us as parents. And so that's why it's so exciting when we get something like that from Dad, who, to him, homeschooling is a commentary that we think everything is wrong with the world, right? And that's not necessarily it. We didn't pull our kids out of school because we thought that the public schools were so terrible and horrible. I know there's homeschoolers that say that. We pulled them out really because we said we want to do everything we possibly can and spend as much time with them as possible before they grow up, so that we can try to instill biblical faith in them. And that's not trying in any way to criticize anybody that didn't choose that option. Now, we firmly believe also that every parent has to make those decisions based on their family dynamic and everything that's going on. So, I remember you guys asked me when I was candidating here, and you said, "Are you kind of one of those homeschoolers that thinks that, you know, if you're not homeschooling, you're evil?" It wasn't the wording they used, but I said, "No, I'm pro homeschooling. If you ask me, should I homeschool my kids? I'll say, absolutely, do it, great." But it's not that we're, you know, looking down condescendingly on those who don't homeschool. So, but it is a very, very important part of our family. So I don't know why I felt the need to throw that in there. I just thought I would. Eldon. Yeah.
And this is a concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wish they would consider homeschooling.
Mm-hmm. But, tell them to call us. We'll talk them into it. We'll do our best anyway. Anybody else got something they want to share? Sorry, I stole the spotlight. Stole the mic there for a little bit. Turn it back over to you. It's all right. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and run a quick summary of where we are at in our series of kingly lessons. We have covered the life of Ahab and Jehoshaphat. Ahab, the king of the north. Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah in the south. And this is bringing us right up to about a century after the division of the kingdom of Israel. So Saul sits on the throne for 40 years. David reigns for 40 years. Solomon reigns for 40 years. That's 120. And then the nation splits in two. And we are now coming to about a century after that event. About 90 years, really. 975 BC is when the kingdom split. And we're going to bring our, last time we brought ourselves right up to about 886 or 885 BC. We're right around 90 years after the division of the kingdom, which puts us just a little over 200 years after Saul began the monarchy. We've covered a lot of history here since the beginning of our study. And last week we covered 2 Kings chapter 9 verses 1 through 13. Where Elisha goes and anoints Jehu to be the next king of Israel. And we asked the question this morning, why is that a problem? Because there's already a king of Israel. Who is he? Who is the current king of the northern kingdom? This one right here. Joram. All right. Joram is whose son? Ahab's son. Okay? Ahab's son. Ahab died and his son Ahaziah took the throne. But Ahaziah only reigned for 2 years. And then he fell off the balcony, injured himself, and died. So his brother Joram took the throne and has ruled for 12 years. So we are looking right here in his 12th year of the reign of Joram, the son of Ahab. Well, down here in the southern kingdom, there's a lot going on. Jehoshaphat was king of the southern kingdom just about the same time that Ahab was king of the northern kingdom. And his son Joram was pro-rex for several years. Pro-rex is a term that means he's not king yet, but we're kind of a king in training. Maybe like an apprenticeship for kings. How'd you like to get into that program, Daniel? Yeah. Where do they do apprenticeship for kings anyway? Yep. Kingapprentice.com. There you go. Well, when toward the end of Jehoshaphat's life, then Joram became co-rex which means you're no longer a king in training. You're now officially the king, and you're sharing the responsibilities with your dad. That went on for 4 years, and then Jehoshaphat died, and Jehoram became the sole Rex, and he was sole Rex for 3 years or so. And what was the problem with Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat? Well, no, he didn't kill everybody in everybody's line. He killed all of his brothers. Remember, he wiped out his brothers so that there would be no challengers to the throne. And God sent a pretty scathing condemnation by the hand of Elijah, the prophet. And we talked about that being interesting because by that point, Elijah had been dead for 7 years. So either this was written preemptively, or it was just written in Elijah's name and Elisha actually delivered it. But either way, God sent him this scathing condemnation, and we get this really interesting epitaph of him that he died with nobody caring. Nobody burned any fires in his honor. Nobody mourned his death. Everybody was glad that Jehoram was gone. That's a pretty bad epitaph. I mean, that's what I want written on my tombstone when I go. We're sorry to see you go. We really hope you never come back, but we're sorry to see you go, right? That's not the kind of epitaph you want to have, especially when it's coming from the Lord to whom you have to give an account. Well, Jehoram's son Ahaziah takes the throne, and that's where we are. Ahaziah is on the throne in the south, and no, I don't want any updates from Acrobat Reader, so let's close that. Ahaziah is on the throne in the south, and Joram is king in the north. But Elisha has just come along and anointed Jehu king of Israel. Jehu has a task. What is Jehu's task from the Lord? You can find it in verse 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 of 2 Kings chapter 9. Right, so this is God's program, God's purpose for Jehu. You're going to carry out my judgment on Ahab. I want you to wipe out his house. Nothing left. Nobody left alive, none of the men anyway, to take rulership. His dynasty is done. Now, where did we hear God pronounce that doom before? Tim. Saul? Oh, I'm sorry, you're going too far back. Regarding Ahab, where else did we hear God talk about Ahab and the end of his line? What event was that connected with? You got it. Naboth's vineyard, right? Naboth's vineyard, back in 1 Kings chapter 21, right after Ahab had Naboth killed unjustly, and took possession of his vineyard, which was right next to the castle, God sent this word and said, "Have you killed and taken possession? Thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick your own blood." And behold, down in verse 21, "Behold, I will bring disaster upon you. I will utterly burn you up and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free, in Israel. And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the anger to which you have provoked me and because you made Israel to sin." So there's this other scathing condemnation of Ahab and his entire house. God is going to wipe it out. There won't be anybody left from Ahab to take the throne. Now, that's all well and good for the northern kingdom, but we said, why is that a problem for Judah? Who is sitting on the throne of Judah? Ahaziah is Joram's son. Who did Joram marry? Ahab's daughter. Which means that Joram's wife is the Joram of Northern Kingdom's sister, somehow. Now, Ahab had a lot of wives, so they're probably half-brother and half-sister. But that means that Ahaziah is related how to Joram, the king of the north? He's closer. He's a nephew. He's sister's son. So if Joram of the north, his sister, a daughter of Ahab, married Jehoram, the king of the south, and they gave birth to Ahaziah, that means Ahaziah is a nephew to the king of the north. So now the king in the southern, I know this is crazy confusing, right? Especially when their names are so similar. But Ahaziah, the king of Judah, is the nephew of Jehoram, the king of the north. And God is saying, I'm going to wipe out every male that belongs to Ahab's house. Is this a problem? Because who's sitting on the throne of Judah? A descendant of Ahab. Now, what else did God promise to Judah? Yeah, one of David's sons will always be sitting on the throne of Israel. This creates a little bit of a trouble, doesn't it? Because now which promise does God keep? So we talked about this last time, and we took a look at Matthew chapter 1, and we said three generations of kings right here, starting with Ahaziah. Ahaziah, Joash, and his son Amaziah are not listed in the royal register of the Messiah, because God is disciplining the line of David for their intermarriage with the line of Ahab. He's going to be faithful not to wipe out David's seed, which we're going to see here, there's going to be an attempt to do so. But he is going to keep his promise to David and preserve one of his sons, but he also has to discipline them for intermarrying with the pagan house of Ahab. So, here we come. Jehu has been anointed. He's been given this task, wipe out Ahab. And he comes out of the room where Elisha's messenger anointed him with oil. And all his generals who are around him ask, is everything okay? Let me bring up our map here, because this is there's going to be some geographical notes that we want to make here. Remember that Jehu, easy for you to say. Jehu is one of the commanders of Jehoram, the king's army. They are currently over in the land of Gilead defending a city from the king of Syria. So there's a war going on right now. And Jehu is one of the commanders. So let me find the place on our map here that we want. There's our cities. We're going to zoom in just a little bit. Make the names of our towns a little bigger so we can see them. Okay. Jehu and his generals are over here in Ramoth-Gilead, over in the land of Gilead. It's called Ramoth-Gilead because it's in Gilead. They are defending the city, probably, from the king of Syria, whose name is Hazael. Remember, God anointed Hazael to be king of Syria? God is at work in these nations around Israel. He is executing his sovereign plan, putting people in places right where they should be so that things are unfold according to his purposes. So Hazael is the king of Syria. Jehu has just been anointed king of Israel, but there is still Jehoram, the king of Israel, to take care of. So he comes out of the back room, and all his fellow generals say to him, and we're in verse 11 of 2 Kings 9. Verse 11 of 2 Kings 9. Is all well? Why did this mad fellow come to you? And he said to them, oh, you know the fellow and his talk. He's trying to brush it aside. Obviously, because it's a very serious thing to proclaim that you are going to take the place of the king. You're proclaiming a coup. You're proclaiming a rebellion. And they said, oh, that's not true. Tell us now. And he said, thus and so he spoke to me, saying, thus says the Lord, I anoint you king over Israel. So now the cat's out of the bag. He's just made this proclamation to his generals. And you can just imagine all of them sitting there staring at each other like, what do we do now? If we go along with this and we're defeated, we're all going to be executed. If we don't go along with this, perhaps we're fighting against the Lord. It's not a real faithful group of people in the northern kingdom, but some of them might be, and they might have believed this prophecy. So verse 13, in haste, every man of them took his garment, put it under him on the bare steps, and they blew the trumpet and proclaimed, Jehu is king. This is like the Twitter announcement going out into the world and telling everybody what we're intending to do. You blow the trumpet, you get everybody's attention, and now they've proclaimed, Jehu is king. So who would immediately hear this trumpet? Yeah, anybody within distance of Ramoth-Gilead to hear it. So, who's with them there? The army. Yeah, the army at least is there. So the army of the northern kingdom is camped over here at Ramoth-Gilead, defending the city from the Syrians, and they blow this trumpet and say, Jehu is the king! Well, now they all know it, they all hear it. So now Jehu is on this path, and there is no returning from it. At this point, he could no longer just go back to his old life and do what he was doing. He has to follow through with this. Okay. Thus, Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. And now Joram, with all Israel, had been on guard at Ramoth-Gilead against Hazael, king of Syria. But Joram had returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds that the Syrians had given him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. So, there's the situation. Jehu and the generals are in Ramoth-Gilead, but where is King Joram? Where does it say he went? Yeah, he went to Jezreel. Jezreel is over here in the valley of Jezreel, central part of the northern kingdom. This is also called the Valley of Megiddo. Important place because this is where the kings of Israel had their summer palace. The capital was down here in Samaria, but they had kind of a summer home up here in Jezreel, which is why Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard, by the way. So the king, Jehoram, is not there to hear this trumpet blowing and to hear the announcement. So Jehu has to take things in hand very quickly. And so he says, Jehu said, if this is your decision, then let no one slip out of the city to go and tell the news in Jezreel. Why would you not want anyone to slip out of the city? Yeah, you don't want anybody running across the valley here and getting to Jezreel and letting King Jehoram know what's happening. Why not?
Because he's still the army might follow him instead.
Okay, so the army might follow him, but why else would you not want him to know what's going on? He might be able to get his defenses ready, and Jehu wants to take care of this thing quickly. And so he wants it to be a surprise. Happy birthday. Just want to bring you a get-well present. It's a sword, by the way. Okay. Yeah. So he doesn't want anybody escaping the city to be able to go and bring the news. So, verse 18, then Jehu mounted his chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there. So he has to make this trip from Ramoth-Gilead down this steep incline. He'd have to find a nice windy road back and forth, and then he'd have to travel up again into Jezreel. It's kind of a long, treacherous little journey. It might only be, let's see how far it is. We'll turn on our handy-dandy ruler, and if you were a crow, it's only 38 miles. That's not too far. How fast can you ride your bike 38 miles, Eldon? About 6 hours, you would have made a good living as a message runner back in the... Yeah, it's a little more mountainous than what we have around here. So, yeah. Well, Jehu makes the trip. Probably took him quite a while, but he's in a hurry because he's trying to outrun any messengers that might be ahead of him. Interesting little tidbit is also given to us in the last part of the sentence. Who else is in Jezreel?
Not Ahab.
Well, she is. Yeah, we're going to get to her. But who does the next sentence say is also in Jezreel? The king of Judah, Ahaziah, is in Jezreel visiting Uncle Jehoram. He's also brought a get-well present. And so there you've got these two kings. So, two kings in Jezreel, and Jehu is driving towards them furiously. So, verse 17. Now the watchman was standing on the tower in Jezreel, and he saw the company of Jehu as he came, and he said, I see a company. And Joram said, take a horseman and send to meet them, and say, is it peace? Why does he send out this message? Yeah, okay, there's a war going on over in Ramoth-Gilead, so Jehoram probably figures this is a messenger coming for some reason from the battlefront. And so to get the news quickly, he sends a horseman out to meet the chariot. A horseman can travel faster than a chariot. And so the idea is, I'm going to send the horseman out there, he's going to get the message and bring it back before the chariot can get here. This is modern rapid, this is ancient rapid communication. All right, they didn't have radios, they didn't have cell phones, so this is how messages got spread. And so he commands for this to happen. Is it peace? So, verse 18. So, a man on horseback went to meet him, that's to meet Jehu, and he said, thus says the king, is it peace? I love Jehu's response. What do you have to do with peace? Turn around and ride behind me. What does that message mean? not really. Why behind me? Yeah, don't go back and deliver my message. Get behind me, let me finish my job. Well, remember, everybody, the watchman and the king are up there on the tower, so they can see quite a ways. And so they see the horseman ride out, they see him stop and talk to the guy in the chariot. And then he sort of falls in line behind him, and now they're both riding onwards. As the watchman, you now have no more information than you had beforehand, except that now there's two guys coming at you. And so, let's see here. The messenger reached them, but he's not coming back. So verse 19, then he sent out a second horseman. Anybody ever heard the definition of insanity? I forget who said this. Daniel? What is it? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting to get a different result, right? So I sent out the first horseman. He turned around and followed the chariot. Well, what's your next idea, king? I got an idea. How about we send out another horseman? Okay, so they send out another horseman with the same message. Thus says the king, is it peace? And Jehu answered, what do you have to do with peace? Turn around and ride behind me. So, naturally, verse 20, again, the watchman reported, he reached them, but he's not coming back. But they've had time, they've approached closer to the city walls now, and so now the watchman, who would be the guy with the best eyes in the entire city, not me, by the way, if I don't have my glasses on, I can see clearly about 8 inches in front of my head. If I have my glasses on, I can see clearly about 9 inches in front of my head, so my sight's not great. Anyway, the watchman's looking out there and he starts to notice something. He says, huh, I think I recognize that driving. The watchman reported back, the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi. And how does he know that? What is noted about Jehu's driving? He drives furiously. How would we put that in the modern vernacular?
He likes to crash a lot.
He's a crazy driver, right? You run into people like this on the road. These are the guys that are weaving in and out of traffic in Chicago freeways. These are the guys that cut you off. That's Jehu. They would have known that because Jehu, being one of the commanders of the army, would have been well known. And so the watchman, probably having had the opportunity to watch them practice around the city, says, wait a second, that looks like Jehu. Have you ever been able to look at somebody walking and identify them? You say, yeah, you know what, everybody has kind of a unique gait to them. And sometimes I've identified sons of men and say, wow, your gait is just like this guy. Oh, yeah, that's my dad. Ha, that makes sense. Right. Okay. So he's identifying him based on his driving habits. He drives furiously. So verse 21, Jehoram said, make ready. Make ready for what? Well, does he know it's a battle yet? Because Jehu is one of his commanders, right? Yes, it's make ready to meet him. Remember, at this point, Joram doesn't know what's going on. And so he's simply going out to meet him. It would be highly unusual for your commander to be delivering a message. He would send somebody like Eldon on his bike instead. So the fact that Jehu is the one driving towards the city has got King Jehoram worked up a little bit. Something's wrong. either we just lost a major battle, like the Carolina Panthers lost to the Pittsburgh Steelers last Thursday. Anybody see that game? Wasn't that a good game? 52-14. Right? Well, either we lost royally to the Syrians, and that's why Jehu's coming, or something else is majorly wrong. So he says, make ready. And they made ready his chariot. And then Jehoram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, set out, each in his chariot, and went to meet Jehu, and met him at the property of who? Whose property are they going to meet him at?
Naboth
the Jezreelite. Ooh, is this starting to spark any memories? Is this starting to sound a little like it should be a warning to King Jehoram? You're standing on the piece of ground that your father murdered a man on and stole, and on which God said, as divine justice, all of your sons are going to die, and their blood's going to be licked up on this parcel of ground. And so Jehoram is standing there, not thinking anything about it. Here comes Jehu. Here's King Ahaziah, your nephew, standing right next to you. And they're on this parcel of ground. Verse 22. And when Joram saw Jehu, he said, is it peace, Jehu? This is one of your generals, by the way. You would assume he's on your side, except that he's been watching this driving and he knows something's wrong. Jehu's response is, what peace can there be so long as the whorings and sorceries of your mother, Jezebel, are so many? Anybody ever given you that response when you picked up the phone and said, hey, hello? You having a good day? How can I be having a good day as long as the whorings and sorceries of your mother are so many? All right, this is an open declaration of war. It's like the old joke, what'd you say about my mama? Except, usually when someone says that, they're getting ready to defend their mother's honor. What's Jehoram going to do? He's going to turn and run. Verse 23, Jehoram reined about and fled, screaming to Ahaziah, treachery, O Ahaziah! So, sorry, nephew, you're on your own. I'm out of here. He turns his chariot and starts running away. And he leaves his nephew Ahaziah there until he screams back at him, treachery! He's going to kill us! Verse 24, Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between the shoulders so that the arrow pierced his heart and he sank in his chariot. He doesn't get far. What parcel of ground is he standing on? Does God keep his promises? Generally speaking, when we talk about God keeping his promises, does that make you feel good or bad? Generally good, because we think about the good promises, right? The promises of blessing. The promises of God's favor that he's given to us. But you know what? God keeps all of his promises, including the ones that have to do with judgment. And so here he is. God is keeping his word. Exactly what he spoke to Ahab back in 1 Kings 21. All of your sons are going to die. They're going to lick up their blood on this parcel of ground. You're not going to have any men left in your family to take the kingship, and God is making sure it happens. So Jehu shoots King Jehoram through the heart with his arrow. He sinks down in his chariot. Verse 25, Jehu said to Bidkar, his aide, this is probably the guy in the chariot with him, because they would have somebody in the chariot to hand them arrows, to hand them armor, weapons, things like that. So Jehu said to Bidkar, his aide, take him up and throw him on the plot of ground belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember, when you and I rode side by side behind Ahab his father, how the Lord made this pronouncement against him. As surely as I saw yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, declares the Lord, I will repay you on this plot of ground. Now therefore, take him up and throw him on that plot of ground in accordance with the Lord, word of the Lord. So they pick him up, they throw him there in the middle of the plot of ground. Who else died on Naboth's vineyard?
Naboth.
Ahab. His dad died there, right? So, verse 27, when Ahaziah, king of Judah, saw this, he fled in the direction of Beth-Hagan. And Jehu pursued him and said, shoot him also! And they shot him in the chariot at the ascent of Gur, which is by Ibleam, and he fled to Megiddo and died there. So let's look at our map and just get an idea of where things are. Jezreel, let me switch here. Jezreel is this town right here on the edge of these hills. Ibleam is down here. Megiddo is up this way. So Ahaziah starts fleeing southward this way when they shoot him. But when he gets shot, he probably figures he needs to go to the closest fortress to try to protect himself. And so they drive him up a little bit northward to Megiddo, where there was a major fortress. And that's where he dies from his wounds. So right there in one day, Jehu takes out two kings. When Ahaziah, they shot him in the chariot, the ascent of Gur, verse 28, his servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in his tomb with his fathers in the city of David. In the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, Ahaziah began to reign over Judah. How long did he reign? 1 year and a little bit more. So he starts to reign here in the 11th year. This verse says the 11th year. You know, a previous verse told us it was the 12th year. So what's going on there? Probably one of them is referring to him becoming pro-rex, king in training with his dad. Because remember, how did his dad die? What was God's pronouncement of doom against Joram or Jehoram? Okay, if you're squeamish, cover your ears. Because this is the man that God said, you're going to have a horrible disease in your bowels. And it says after the end of 2 years, all of his bowels came out and he died. Okay, horrible death. So probably for the last year or so of his reign, he was unable to take on the duties of being king because he's sick. And so his son is declared pro-rex. In the 11th year of Joram, king of the north, he becomes sole rex here in the 12th year. And so either way you go, you can say he started the reign in the 11th year or he started the reign in the 12th year. Okay. And so that's the end of Ahaziah. It was a short-lived rule. He followed in the footsteps of his wicked father because he's the son of a woman named Athaliah, who is the daughter of King Ahab, who is the sister of Joram, the king of the north. And we have this crazy, convoluted, mixed-up thing going on. Well, Jehu's not done. He's going to continue to execute God's discipline upon the house of Ahab. And so who's left? Which prominent figure is now left in the house of Ahab? Jezebel. Okay, verse 30. When Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. By this point, her husband's dead, and so is the king of the southern kingdom. Jezebel, however, not to be shown up in any way. She is a proud king's daughter. She's the proud wife of a king. She's the proud mother of kings. She's not going to let this go without a lot of pomp and circumstance. So she painted her eyes, adorned her head, looking every bit the queen, and she looks out the window as Jehu entered the gate, and she says, "Is it peace, you Zimri, murderer of your master?" That seems like kind of a funny question, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to call him murderer of your master, do you think you'd really expect it to be peace? So she's telling him that she knows what he's up to. Right? It's not peace. And he lifted up his face to the window, and notice this, he doesn't even talk to her. He doesn't try to negotiate with her. He doesn't try to parlay with her at all. He simply says, "Who's on my side? Who?" And two or three eunuchs look out at him. Who are the eunuchs?
They were like leaders of the group of soldiers.
Probably not. They were male servants, and what was their main job? Attend to the queen. Okay. So, here's the story, the situation. Jehu sticks his head out and says, "Who's on my side?" Well, obviously, what does everybody know in the town? Sorry, I'm mixing up my words here. What does everybody in the town know that that means? I'm here to get rid of Jezebel. And so who sticks their heads out to see what he wants? The people that wait on the queen. What does this tell you about Queen Jezebel? Probably not a good gal to work for, right? They're not loyal to her at all. So these two eunuchs stick their head out the window. And he says, throw her down. So they threw her down. Okay, once again, if you're squeamish, go ahead and cover your ears, right? Because this part's gruesome. Some of her blood splattered on the wall and on the horses, and they trampled on her. Say, okay, Jehu, this might just be a little bit spiteful, don't you think? Not only is she lying there dead, but they bring the horses up and just kind of stomp her into the ground. Right? This is brutal stuff. What's he do next in verse 34? He goes into the castle and eats supper. I mean, how many of you are hungry after reading these descriptions? That's that's true. Abby says pushing people out the window really gives you an appetite. So, well, I mean, we can understand why Jehu is hungry. He just drove 40 miles across the mountainous terrain of Gilead in order to get there. He's killed two kings already. So yeah, he has worked up an appetite. And so he goes inside and he eats supper. And then he says, see now to this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter. Well, we're going to give her some consideration because she's a king's daughter. And so he tells his people, go on out and bury her. Well, what are you going to bury? You threw her out the window. You trampled her into the ground. This is going to be hard to clean up, isn't it? Except that, what had God pronounced about Jezebel back in 1 Kings 21? The dogs are going to eat Jezebel. So, let's see what's going on. Verse 35, when they went out to bury her, they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. And they came back and told him, and he said, this is the word of the Lord which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite. In the territory of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be as dung on the face of the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, this is Jezebel. Is it an honoring thing or dishonoring to have no body left to bury? It's usually considered a dishonoring thing. It's an honor shown to a person to be able to bury them properly. Jezebel, there's nothing left of her except her head, her hands, and her feet. Because the dogs ate it. How do you feel about puppy dogs now? Yeah. Okay, so our puppy dog has been raised to be cute and adorable, but not all dogs are that way, right? So, God has fulfilled his word again. Ahab died on Naboth's land, and his blood was licked up by the dogs. One of Ahab's sons has died on that land. And Jezebel has died right next to that land. God is fulfilling his promises both for judgment and for blessing. Well, we haven't seen a whole lot of blessing in this chapter because it's a chapter all about judgment. But it shows you that God does keep his promises. So when God speaks of a coming judgment for us, well, not for us, but for this world, he will keep it. And as Peter talks about, they can scoff all they want, thinking that things are just continuing on the way that they have been, but God has said there is a judgment coming upon this world. It will come. It'll come in his time, but it will come. Any questions about anything we covered here? Hey, we covered most